The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Gail McGovern, President and CEO of the American Red Cross, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
There is nothing on this show I enjoy doing more than taking an organization that we are all so familiar with, but don't really fully understand or appreciate, and learn about their challenges, all that they actually do, and how they go about doing it. And there may be no finer example than that than the American Red Cross. And it's a great pleasure to have with us this evening their President and Chief Executive Officer, Gail McGovern. Good evening, Gail, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much, Denver, and I really appreciate being on your show. Thank you.
It seems the Red Cross has just always been there, and it has touched so many of our lives at one time or another. But share with us some of the history of the organization and a few key milestones along the way.
So the American Red Cross was founded by Clara Barton in 1881. And most people don't know this, but there are 191 Red Cross societies and Red Crescent societies around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
So I have 190 counterparts. In addition to having this robust network of national societies, we have a federation that coordinates us. So if there's a disaster in an area that's too big for one country to handle, federation will help us figure out who needs to help and what sort of help they need to give. And there's also the Committee of the Red Cross, the International Committee of the Red Cross. Their sole purpose is to ensure that humanitarian law is in effect. So they go behind enemy lines. They make sure that prisoners of war are being handled appropriately. And together, it's probably the largest humanitarian movement in the world. There are 19 million volunteers, all told.
Wow, that's astounding. And the relationship that the American Red Cross has with the federal government is a special one, a unique one. What is the nature of that relationship?
Well, I affectionately call it our unfunded mandate. most people think that we are getting funding from the federal government. In fact, about a quarter of the people in our country think we're an agency of the federal government. But all of our funding comes from private individuals, corporations. But the reason I say we have a congressional mandate is that it is by law our responsibility to give mass care and feeding during a disaster. And we have that responsibility along with FEMA, who is the co-lead of that particular set of events. And there's a national framework where there are 13 parts to this framework, and everyone has a role and responsibility. We're the only nonprofit that's baked into that framework. So Department of Defense will do search and rescue. Department of Energy will make sure the power gets back on, all the way to mass care and feeding. And so we do sheltering and feeding and making sure people have a roof over their head.
Yeah, well, that's a very unique and important perch indeed. And as you said, I think you're most closely identified with disaster relief, but that's only part of the story. Another part of the story, and one that is perhaps not fully appreciated, is what you do to support servicemen and women, veterans, and their families. And it's really quite a lot. Tell us about it.
Well, really glad you asked this question, because they say that one in five people in our country have been touched by the American Red Cross in some way. But what we do for the military is almost like a well-kept secret. Most people don't realize it. However, I find that if I go to an airport with my Red Cross pin on and I stop a service member and I thank them for their service, they will tell me a Red Cross story. So Wow. The military knows us well. So first of all, we receive about 420,000 phone calls every year for emergencies.
My.
And this could be anything from get my daughter home, her father is on his deathbed,
mm-hmm.
or get my husband home, he's about to become a father for the first time. sadly, we're getting about one call a day on average from concerned family members who are worried about a veteran in their family or a service member in their family that they may be contemplating suicide. Mm-hmm. And we're handling those calls as well. So these connections are really important. And we convene all the relief agencies that touch the military. So if it's something we can't handle, we will make sure that that veteran or service member has an outreach to a whole host of other nonprofits that can help them out. So we take calls on behalf of ourselves, but also we parse them into other organizations. We have volunteers on every VA hospital. We greet every wounded warrior when they come back to the U.S.
Fantastic.
And they come to two places, either Fort Belvoir or Walter Reed.
Mm-hmm.
At Walter Reed alone, we have 800 volunteers. These are doctors, nurses, physical therapists, et cetera. We have volunteers on every military base, including in theater. We have volunteers that were in Iraq, that were in Afghanistan, and they are getting these emergency messages to the right person, dealing with the commanding officer, morale boosters. It's really quite important for everything that we do, and it's something that I'm very proud of, and it touches me personally because I have a stepson who's an active duty airman. He's a master sergeant in the Air Force, and he often tells me how grateful he is that he knows what he would do if there were an emergency.
That could be a nonprofit organization unto itself. It is so big and so extensive. Then there are blood donations. And we have a serious problem in this country, Gail, particularly during the summer months with donations of blood, of which the Red Cross supplies some 40%. Do you know why not as many people are donating blood today as once was the case?
You know, it's a great question, and it's one that perplexes me and my colleagues in the United States that are also in the blood banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's a worldwide problem. The number of new donors is going down, and it has done that over time. So there are a couple of things that might be contributing to it. There are so many people that telecommute. So if a big company is throwing a blood drive, you know, there are less employees that are there that particular day. There are lots of restrictions on people who donate if they travel to certain parts of the world.
That's right.
And people are traveling more often. And, you know, it could be that it's just not top of mind.
Mm-hmm.
But we are doing whatever we can to increase the number of new donors and also to touch lapsed donors.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big marketing campaign, and you pointed out that the summer is challenging. It really is a challenging time because we collect a lot of blood from universities, colleges, even high schools.
Out of session.
And they're out of session.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a troublesome problem because July and August, there are a lot more accidents. So there are more instances of trauma and
less supply and more demand.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So the need is constant. In fact, this number still astounds me. We need 15,000 people a day to show up to donate blood. And then the next day, we need a different 15,000 people because you can't keep donating blood every single day, obviously. So, you know, the fact that these people present and selflessly open up their veins to save the life of a total stranger, it fills my heart with their generosity. It's really pretty incredible.
Well, you've had some interesting promotions, too. Share some of those.
So we recently, in fact, right now, we're running a promotion with giving our blood donors a $5 gift card from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was generously donated by Suburban Propane, a company that is a big fan of the American Red Cross. And it's kind of a cool thing because it's a way we can acknowledge and thank our donors. But the other thing that's cool about it is a lot of them will say, no, you can keep it.
Yeah.
So it's also acting as a reminder for people to get out there and donate blood.
Mm-hmm. Training is another big piece of what you do. Millions and millions of lessons provided every year. What are some of those lessons where you train and teach?
So a big course is first aid and CPR. And by the way, statistically speaking, 27% of us are going to eventually see someone that's in cardiac distress.
I saw that. I couldn't believe it.
It's
one out of four, over at one out of four.
Over one out of four. And so it's really important for people to take a first aid CPR course. And if you just don't have the time, we have a ton of apps,
mm-hmm.
12 million downloads of these apps. But one of my favorite ones is the first aid app. You open up your phone, right there on the phone, you can dispatch 911. And there's video and explanation in alphabetical order of anything that could possibly happen to you.
And people can get that on their
allergies.
Website?
Not only that, but literally the day we put this up, it's on your smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
So the day we put it up, one of the reviews, 5-star review, said, I just saved my grandmother from choking with my iPhone.
Wow.
So it's pretty incredible.
Yes.
It's a really good thing to have in your hand.
Quite the testimonial.
It really was. And the reviews are very similar that we get mm-hmm. as a result. So we teach first aid and CPR. We teach swimming lessons. We teach lifeguarding. Junior lifeguarding.
We got a shortage of lifeguards, right?
We really do. And the course is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's really wonderful. We teach babysitting classes. We very often will just do free CPR Saturdays and just teach chest compressions, for example. It's a really important thing about our mission. And it seems like wherever I go, I'm recognizing an ordinary person who has done something extraordinary to save a life.
Yeah.
There were two grandparents who were walking through the street in Minnesota, and they heard screams, and this 4-year-old kid had fallen through a frozen lake. Pulled her out, did first aid CPR on her for 20 minutes, and that kid is perfectly fine today. An 11-year-old took a babysitting class. She saved her 3-year-old sister from choking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a beautiful thing. It's important. And the swim side of it's important, too. There are 50 cities where the drowning rate is abnormally high compared to the national norm. So we went into these cities mm-hmm. and we're teaching kids to swim, a ton of them, for free. And we did 50,000 in 3 years. We just did 25,000 this last year. And, you know, these are kids that can't swim,
yeah.
and they wind up joining the swim team. They wind up being lifeguards. It's a really cool thing.
Sure is. I think 19% of Americans can't swim. And I'm one of those Americans who can swim, and I probably should be in the other side of that statistic because I can't swim very far, that's for sure. So, you know, we were talking about when people think of the Red Cross, they think of disaster relief. And what am I thinking about now? I'm thinking about earthquakes. I'm thinking about hurricanes. I'm thinking about floods. But the Red Cross responds to many, many smaller disasters, particularly house fires. How common an occurrence are they, and what do you do here and to protect homes against fires?
So most people, in fact, I'd probably argue almost everyone knows we respond to big disasters,
mm-hmm.
like you said. But we actually respond to 64,000 disasters on average every year.
Mm.
And once every 8 minutes, we are responding to a disaster. And as you pointed out, the vast majority of them are home fires. And the vast majority of those home fires are caused by cooking accidents.
Hmm.
So it can happen to anyone, any socioeconomic group, anywhere, any place. And some of the there are 2,500 deaths a year from home fires, way bigger than natural disasters. So these can be prevented if people do two things. They need to have working smoke alarms, and they need a plan to get out of their home in 2 minutes or less. That sounds like a ridiculous number, but it's 2 minutes or less.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if you live in a mansion or if you live in, you know, a one-bedroom apartment. It is essential to get out. Everything goes up very quickly
these days.
So we were watching this, and we're responding so often, and we are dispatched by the fire department. We give comfort and hope, and we give people a place to stay, and we give them some financial assistance. But we thought, we've got to do something about this. So we started a home fire campaign.
Hmm.
And we have installed 1.4 million free smoke alarms. And when I say installed, I don't mean we're just giving them out. We go door to door with a stepladder, a drill, and tons of free smoke alarms.
That's great.
And the cool thing about it is people just let us in because they see the
Red Cross logo.
And they're so delighted. And so we're focusing on areas that are prone to home fires, that are in challenged, vulnerable communities where the socioeconomic situation is not great.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine a family that is trying to figure out, should I fill my kid's diabetes drug or should I buy a smoke alarm?
Mm.
For them, a smoke alarm is a luxury. So we go in, we install them, then we make sure they have a way to get out and they know they have to get out in 2 minutes. And if they have smoke alarms, we check the batteries, and you'd be amazed how many don't even have batteries in them anymore. And, you know, I know a lot of people that take them out because they're ringing and they're annoying. So we make sure they're in working order. And as a result of this campaign, there were 464 lives saved. And I love thinking about those people. Some of them were children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everything they wind up doing in life is because they had a smoke alarm in their home.
Yeah.
And
right.
they knew what to do to get out. In fact, one story, if you'll indulge me, it was a family of four, five-year-old kid, three-year-old kid, and the parents. They had smoke alarms. They had batteries.
Mm-hmm.
They were in good shape. Then we asked them, how long do you think you have to get out of the house? And they said, oh, 5-10 minutes. We made them do some fire drills. About 3 days later, they had a fire. Smoke alarm went out. We had told them, watch out for your kids because they tend to hide in the closet. Because they're scared when they hear the noise.
Huh.
The five-year-old woke up first, ran into her brother's room, pulled him out of the closet, and then woke up the parents. And they all got out in time because this kid knew about the fire drill. So it's a beautiful thing when it works, and we are bound and determined. Oh, the other thing we're doing is training kids in schools, grades 1 through 3.
Mm-hmm.
We've done 1.2 million kids. These kids go home, and they nag their parents about having a fire drill, and they've become preparedness ambassadors, and I'm hoping the next generation is better prepared than the one we're in right now.
Can't start early enough.
Exactly.
And again, talking about the things that you do that a lot of people don't know, that certainly would be near the top of the list. Well, let's get on to those big disasters. My goodness, last year in this country we had Houston, and we had Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and I think Irma was down in Florida. This year, it's a volcano in Hawaii, and there's floods right now in Pennsylvania, and oh my goodness, these devastating wildfires out west. Tell us about some of the work where the Red Cross is currently involved.
Well, the other thing you skipped is the floods in Iowa.
Yes,
they were pretty dramatic as well. So right now we're really focusing on the wildfires. The good news is we were able to shut down some of the shelters in the two biggest fires that were taking place. At the peak, we had 1,100 people living in shelters.
Mm-hmm.
But we are really resourced up because this keeps happening. In fact, now there's a new fire that just started called the Holy Fire. And we had 14 people in the shelters, but that isn't contained yet. So, you know, this thing just keeps evolving. And what's troublesome is this is not the season for wildfires.
I know.
And nevertheless, it's happening. And the Carr Fire, I believe, was the largest wildfire in all of California's history. So it is devastating, and it's just gobbling up so much acreage. I'm really proud of the work that we've done there because 80% of the workforce that we had there came from California. So it was a classic example of neighbor helping neighbor. And we had about, at the peak, over 1,000 volunteers and workers there, and well over 90% of them were volunteers.
That's
so
right.
It's a lot of work. And, you know, you mentioned the season last year. Oh, my gosh. At one point, we had 320,000 people living in Red Cross shelters. And that's the population of Pittsburgh. And when you are dealing with a population the size of Pittsburgh, anything can happen. So in three separate shelters, three different women went into labor the same day.
Oh, wow.
It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. Our volunteers got them to the local hospital. They came back with their babies. And I had the privilege of meeting a 3-day-old, 5-pound baby girl.
Oh, wow.
And in the next half hour, I kid you not, a woman who was 85 years old was wheeled into our shelter in a hospital bed with her hospital ID still on her wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And every age and circumstance in between. It was really quite a stunning year for us, and with a lot of challenges.
In fact, I think your team prepared for 7 major disasters, and you said, well, that's a great exercise, but it's never going to happen.
That's exactly
Lo
right.
Lo and behold,
that's
they better
exactly
prepare for 10
right.
this year.
That is exactly right. They came in, they told me, we need to be able to house 500,000 people, serve 1 million meals a day. We need to galvanize 50,000 volunteers, and that's what it's going to take for us to be ready. So I said, great, go ahead. And I was thinking that's not going to happen. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And we were ready for it.
Clear up for me a misconception that I have. And that is when a disaster strikes, particularly a hurricane or an earthquake or a flood, there's a tremendous call for public support and financial support. And people respond. And I see crawlers on TV and things of that sort. I never see that with wildfires. Would that be the case?
So we do have crawlers on TV. Yeah. We do raise money for wildfires as well. I'm happy to report that we raised enough money to cover all of our expenses and the wildfires that we experienced recently in California. They just don't get as much news coverage. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's a lot of evacuation, and that's extremely important. But people then are released and able to go back home. So I think that's a little bit of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
There is something that just tugs at people's heartstrings when they see a person rescued off of a rooftop because of a hurricane or
yeah.
a tornado or a situation like that. But the American public never ceases to amaze me.
Oh, no,
their generosity.
They're amazing.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So, you know, you hear about this culture of divisiveness and tribalism, and I don't see it. I see generosity. I see resiliency. I see kindness. It's a privilege to be part of the Red Cross
well,
to get to see
it. One of the reasons a lot of people think you have the best job in America, because you do see the best of human nature. You really do.
I really do.
Yeah.
I really think I do.
Gail, how do you prepare for a disaster, and particularly, let's say, one there's been a good deal of warning, like a hurricane?
You know, I mentioned those statistics. We have 8 warehouses that we keep fully stocked. What most people don't know is when it's a hurricane, we have spent so much money before the hurricane even hits. So when people give us designated dollars for a storm, we love it. We program it. We make sure it goes in the right hands. But people need to understand that a lot of that money is being spent before the disaster
yep.
even strikes.
Mm-hmm.
So money for an unrestricted disaster relief fund is the way we're able to pull this off. So we make sure those 8 warehouses are completely stocked with cleaning supplies, hygiene kits, ready-to-eat meals, cots, blankets, you know, anything you would need to be able to stand up a shelter. We have volunteers that stand at the ready. We have a lot of in-kind miles so we can get them from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
But a typical volunteer, you know, when the weather comes for a hurricane, there's a big cone. And we will start stationing and pre-positioning volunteers in that whole cone and then move them as it gets closer and we know where it's headed. The key is to get them there along with the supplies before the storm hits, because after it hits, airports are closed and, you know, people have no place to stay.
Mm-hmm.
We have a national shelter system with 62,000 shelters in it, and we don't own any of that real estate. There's schools, there are convention centers, there are churches.
Partners.
So we make sure they're partners.
Mm-hmm.
So we make sure that they're in the ready. And speaking of partners, we have over 100 memorandums of understanding with nonprofits, for-profits, because when one of these hits, it takes a lot more than one agency to be able to
all
respond.
All hands on deck, yeah.
You better believe it.
What about technology? You've been at this post for 10 years now, so I can only imagine the technology you're deploying today is dramatically different than what you were deploying 10 years ago to make the American Red Cross more responsive. Give us an idea how some of that has changed.
First of all, my background is in computer programming,
mm-hmm.
when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, I might add. But so I kind of love technology just by my nature. But we deployed, as an example, a new system called RCView. And it uses geosatellite technology, and we can see what is going on the ground. We can see where our feeding trucks are. We can see how many people are going to shelters. We can see damage assessment. Its maiden voyage was during the floods in Louisiana, which
mm-hmm.
were huge.
Yeah.
And we thought, are we ready to beta test this on something so big? And we just went for it. And it used to be our volunteers would be 2 in a car. They would drive up a street. One used a clipboard and wrote down which houses looked damaged. Then they would turn around, go to the other side, and they would write down on that side what houses were damaged. It took forever.
Yes.
But, you know, it was kind of, it had to be done.
It took you a long time to say it.
Exactly. So, you know, this was a very manually intensive way of responding.
Lots of paper.
RCView, we see where the damage is immediately. And we were able to deploy caseworkers from their homes. We didn't even have to fly them in.
Hmm.
And they started making outbound calls to these communities saying, okay, here's a number, call me. And we were able to get them relief much, much quicker. And that one deployment, just the Louisiana floods, we saved $4 million.
Wow.
And that $4 million went right back to relief to mm-hmm. help the people that were impacted. So the technology we're using is really cool. I mean, we're teaching Alexa, Amazon's Echo product, how to do first aid CPR. We are using chatbots. If you want to figure out if you're eligible to donate blood, you can just put in something and the bot will figure it out for you. And it's incredibly accurate.
Just removing those barriers that prevent people from doing the little things that they intend to do but just never do.
Exactly right. It's really an extraordinary transformation for us.
I'm old enough that I can remember a time when disaster relief was primarily the purview of government and NGOs. But today, corporations and businesses are engaged in a very significant way. It's become more of the disaster relief industry. How has that involvement changed the way the work is getting done?
Well, you said something really interesting, which I'm going to repeat. It's all hands on deck mm-hmm. during a disaster. And, you know, there was a point in the Red Cross history before I had arrived that we thought, well, we have to do everything on our own. And it really doesn't work very well.
Not anymore.
You know, you go into one of our mega shelters, for example, and you will see people with T-shirts on from so many different organizations, for-profit, non-profit. Is it a big business? I think it's a big humanitarian business for the most part. You know, the care and the compassion and, you know, literally our volunteers that are deployed on big disasters have 12-hour shifts 7 days a week for three solid weeks. And we have to drag them out of there and send them home. I mean, there's something really special about the humanitarian side of all of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, to my way of thinking, the more the merrier, honestly. And we have so many relationships with corporations. They are so helpful to us. That technology I described, we put business cases in front of about five or six companies, and they funded the whole thing. So, you know, we love the relationship that we have with business, and it takes
Didn't
a lot
Salesforce
of—
Didn't pick up the tab for Hawaii, Mark?
That was an absolute amazing act of generosity. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. He paid for what he thought it was going to cost. Then we let him know that it was costing more, but that we were going to raise funds for it. And he said, no, I'm going to pay for that part too. And just like this, sent me
Sweet.
An email. And yeah, and Salesforce is an amazing partner on so many different ways.
They certainly are.
They are.
Yeah. You know, as so often the case, Gail, the biggest player in the field of endeavor is also the one with the biggest target on their back. And the Red Cross, you know, you've come in for your fair share of criticism. After Houston last year, for instance, some people said they were in need of help and the Red Cross wasn't there for them. Others questioned how the money was being used and deployed. And ProPublica has done a number of critical stories. How do you respond to those concerns?
So, first of all, we're a beloved brand. Our trust, we measure our trust. It's always in the 70s. You know, maybe a blip now and then, but it's always averaging in the 70s. And when you are a big, beloved brand, well, let's put it this way. There's nothing interesting about writing a story that says the American Red Cross saved lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more interesting if you can find a misstep. So criticism kind of comes in two categories. One, deserved criticism. And when that happens, we admit our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
We learn from them. And the criticism makes you feel uncomfortable, but nevertheless, it makes you better. So,
yep.
You know, for that, you know, I have no problem with it. Some of it is a bit misleading with sensational headlines. And when that happens, unfortunately, people are so busy and there's so much news coming at them that they retweet, quote unquote, fake news
mm-hmm.
11 times more. Then they retweet the real news because the fake news has more interesting headlines.
Well, more sensational.
It's more sensational. So when that happens, and it happens, we do our best to just dispel the myths and put out the facts. And I think if anyone came to our website, they would see exactly how we're spending the money. I believe we lead the sector in transparency. I mean, if you look at where we spent the money in Hurricane Harvey, which you mentioned,
yep.
every single dime is accounted for. And on average, 91 cents of every dollar we spend is going to our services. We keep our overhead really low. We're kind of maniacal about it. So, you know, I just hate spending any money that isn't mission related. So, we really try everything we can to be more efficient and effective. And in Houston, which you mentioned, we gave 575,000 households $400. Mm-hmm. So we spent about $230 million giving instant relief. Now, we had a set of criteria. I mean, I wish I could have helped everyone that was impacted at all, but there was just not enough money to be able to do that. So we targeted the people whose homes were damaged beyond repair, who were in financial need, who were impacted. I mean, we had people applying for aid, honestly, from China and from Ireland. And so, so at the end, I'm really proud of what we did during Hurricane Harvey. I mean, it hurts to have to say no, but you can't help everyone. And so we helped the people that were in the most dire need, and we're still there, and we're still giving financial assistance, and we're giving grants to other nonprofits that can help as well.
Let's turn to your tenure at the Red Cross. When you arrived there back in 2008, you walked in to an incredibly difficult situation, a $209 million operating deficit, and the organization was literally borrowing money to make payroll. But you were able to balance that budget in just 2 years. How did you approach that challenge, Gail, and making those tough decisions, but also knowing you needed people to follow you after the ship was righted?
So, it was an interesting journey, I have to say. So,
yeah.
So when I came in, I could see it. I could see what needed to be done. And it wasn't that complicated, really. Mm-hmm. Getting it done was complicated, but what needed to be done was pretty evident. We had 720 different chapters. Each one had a CEO. Each one had infrastructure under them that was necessary if you were operating alone, if you were a separate charity. But we were all part of one charity.
Mm-hmm.
So with it came a lot of expense. Every chapter had their own general ledger, their own financial systems, their own bank accounts, their own website. If you put in disaster relief in Google, we wouldn't even come up because there were 720 little websites.
Yeah.
So it was pretty evident that all that back office stuff had to become centralized.
Mm-hmm.
The trick of it was doing it without losing the hearts and minds of the people that were there.
Yeah.
And it would have been tempting to just rip the Band-Aid off and say, da-da. But what I learned very early on was the culture of the American Red Cross. They are so mission-driven. I mean, Red Crossers just are there to help others.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you could lead through the lens of, we have to save the American Red Cross, and through the lens of who would be there to fulfill our mission if we aren't, it kind of turned it around.
Changed everything.
It did. And honestly, I don't think people understood the situation we were in. You know, when we laid out the financials to those 720 CEOs and showed them what the place was, where we were heading, people kind of laid down their self-interest. I mean, it was a journey. It took a while. But the fallout was actually fairly minimal, and most of the fallout was very friendly.
Mm.
People said, you know, I didn't quite sign up for this. I get it. I support it. But I think I'm going to try to do something else. But almost everyone stuck with it, and almost everyone stayed and helped. And the incredible thing were the sacrifices we had to make. Some of it was easy money, honestly. Everyone was doing their own purchasing. So we were probably the only organization in the world that was paying retail for everything.
Really?
So
leveraging
nothing. So when we consolidated purchasing, that was $50 million right there.
Yeah.
Everybody was doing their own audits and paying tax accountants.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
That was another $5 million right there. So, you know.
And it's funny how there's always a misconception, at least I have found, at that local level, because they always look to the national and think how the national is sort of ripping them off and how they're funding them and how they're supporting them. And it's only when you get transparent and they see, oh, my goodness, they're actually the ones that are subsidizing us. It does change, but that's never their original thought.
You are so right. In fact, I think the way we won the minds and hearts of everybody was to just be totally transparent with the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just said, here is the situation. And P.S., we did something really bold that had me up at night for a number of weeks. We just took away the assessment. Mm. We said, you do not have to pay dues to us anymore.
Mm.
And just we said to them, raise money for the Red Cross. We were also chipping on each other during fundraising.
Yeah, sure.
We were fundraising. They were fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, you do all the fundraising. We will do none of it. Just raise money for the Red Cross, for your chapter, for the whole Red Cross, whatever your donors want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Ask for big asks. Go do the fundraising. And we'll do all this back office junk that mm-hmm. you don't even like to do. And, you know, the sleepless nights were, can they do it? Can they raise money for the whole Red Cross?
It was trust putting in them, stuff like that.
And you know
what?
And
of course, if you're a local chapter, you don't like that too, because you say, you take my assessment away, I have nothing to gripe about.
Well, you know what was a defining moment? I loved it. They were like, but what if we can't raise the money?
Mm-hmm.
And I was teasing them. I had a whole group of them in. I said, you know, I have more confidence in you than you have in you. I said, you can do it. Just do it. Everybody loves the Red Cross.
Yeah.
Just go out there and do it. And lo and behold, I think we were all surprised that they were able to start turning our fundraising around, too.
Well,
so
you believe them.
Yeah.
Speaking about your fundraising, boy, at a time of disaster, people support the Red Cross like no other organization. But with that said, is fundraising a challenge at times when a major disaster is not there that galvanizes the public?
It's a great question. And honestly, disasters do keep us top of mind. People see us. They're thinking about us. They're seeing the good work we're doing. So it helps. But as I tell my team over and over again, we are humanitarians and we do not like disasters. They hurt people. They harm people. They cause heartbreak. So, and you just have to go to a Red Cross shelter and see what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say, gee, I hope we have another one of these so we cover our expenses. I mean, you just don't want that to happen.
No.
So we've gotten much more adept at talking about the 64,000 disasters, of talking about the need to be ready for the next disaster, about the great works that we do for the military. We've just gotten a lot better of talking about the mission, and it's made it a lot easier to fundraise.
I bet it has. Well, your legacy is probably going to be having turned around the financial fortunes of the organization at a very precarious time in its history. But you have said you would like your legacy to be having made the Red Cross the very best place to work and to volunteer. What are some of the things that you do to help shape and influence the corporate culture of the Red Cross?
It's a great question. So, first of all, the underpinnings of the culture itself were great.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not very much to do with that. Because it's mission-driven, it's caring, it's compassionate, and believe it or not, it's a culture that kind of naturally embraces change.
Hmm.
And people will kill for that culture.
Yeah.
You know,
they don't like uncertainty, but they will embrace
that's
change.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the reason why it attracts people that are like that is because no two disasters are the same.
Yeah.
And so there's always change. The sand is always shifting under
mm-hmm.
your feet. And I think it's in our DNA. I have a quote in my office from Clara Barton, and I can't say it exactly right, but it's, I defy the tyranny of precedence. I just love that line.
That's a great line.
And then she says, I always look for ways to improve the past. And so when
you know what my favorite Clara Barton quote is? She says, I may sometimes be willing to teach for nothing, but if I'm going to be paid at all, I shall never do a man's work for less than a man's pay.
And do you know what she did after that? She forewent her salary
uh-huh,
and kept
right.
teaching for free.
That's right.
Yeah,
she did the first part of that.
She's my hero. She really is. I channel her whenever I can. But so it's a culture that embraces change naturally. And it's a culture that's very compassionate. The problem is, and it's very similar to businesses that I have familiarity with, it gets siloed.
Hmm.
So the people that are doing disaster don't really work with the people that are doing blood donations or, you know, recruiting blood donors, and they don't work with the people that are training. There's no vitriol between
yeah.
them.
But everybody's just busy
we're just
with what they're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
we're
not
siloed.
A lot of peripheral vision.
That's exactly right. So what I would love to do is have a culture where we all are working with each other, where we do cross-pollinization across these silos so people know the different lines of service.
How do you do that?
You know, one of the things that we did that was absolutely two things. One, we set up a high potential program at the Red Cross. And so we move a number of tomorrow's leaders from experience to experience so they get a good vantage point. But the other thing, which was an unintended consequence, and it was great, is these smoke alarm campaigns. You know, the one that I was recently on, we had people from our IT department, from legal, from finance, from, you know, areas that would never touch the mission that way, from our biomed business, from our health and safety business. And the next thing you know, people re-fell in love with the Red Cross. You know, they're welcome into a stranger's home. They're helping them potentially save lives. They re-fell in love with the mission. So we're trying to
And they're
to
doing it with somebody from a different department.
Exactly.
So they're getting to know somebody else in the
That's
organization.
Exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So I'm kind of really all about getting employee engagement up, getting volunteer satisfaction up, because that's more sustainable than a financial turnaround.
And you're also all about hiring great people. And I know that you are exceptionally proud of the senior team that you have assembled at the Red Cross. Everybody knows you want to hire great people, but how do you go about it? What are some of your tricks of the trade?
So I'm a little bit of a maniac about this, I have to say. And I have a reputation of driving people crazy because I will limp along with the vacancy for as long as it takes for me to get the best person
Good
in that job.
You. Mm-hmm.
And I have seen more people hire for expediency and then dig out of a personnel problem and wish they never did it. I'd much rather keep that job open until the right person comes in. And I don't necessarily look for someone who can do the job when they walk in. I know this sounds lame, but people don't do it. I look for smart and I look for nice.
Yeah.
And if they have those two traits, you can pretty much teach somebody anything. I mean, you may not be able to teach them to be a brain surgeon, but in business and in nonprofit, you can pretty much teach them just about anything. And there's nothing worse than hiring somebody who's really smart who isn't nice.
No, no, absolutely. Because you know, what happens, everybody then has to respond to that person not being nice, and sometimes it makes them less nice. It becomes contagious because all the trust that you build in an organization, one person can undo that trust. And that's why you've always said if there's 1% nagging doubt,
just keep waiting. The other thing I do, and I'm in the process of doing it right now, and it drives my team crazy, but I make every single person at my leadership table interview the incoming person. One thumbs down, I won't hire them.
There you go.
Because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They start saying, I told you they weren't going to work out. And it's unhealthy. But I also do not staff for like-mindedness. That's a problem.
Oh, sure.
Because you're all really happy. You love each other. You walk right off a cliff together.
That's right. It's like having a desk drawer with 12 pairs of scissors.
No
stapler.
That.
No Scotch tape.
I love that. I am going to use that, and I will give you attribution for it, Denver.
Had Ken Dudak on the show from Fountain House, and he also hires for one thing that he says can't be taught, and that is positive people.
Oh, I
he
know.
Says you if a person's either born positive or not, and there's just no teaching a person who's not predisposed to be positive to ever be positive. And I remember that very
that
well.
That is so perfect. Well, I'll tell you something that my husband and my daughter accuse me of all the time. They say, you are a card-carrying member of the happy club.
Yeah, that, I can be that way. That can be annoying, by the way, just so you know.
Definitely.
You're also a card-carrying member of the workaholic club, too. And I know work-life balance can be a challenge for many nonprofit organizations, but especially one where there can be irregular hours. And there certainly is an emotional toll when you're seeing victims of natural disasters. Parkland would be a great example. You work hard, very, very hard. But so how do you promote a healthy work-life balance at the American Red Cross?
So this is a really great question and a tough one to answer. When I was in corporate America, I was an officer at AT&T. I had a two-year-old kid, and my husband had lymphoma. And I somehow managed to have work-life balance.
Yeah.
I didn't really have much of a choice. I would pack up my stuff at 6 o'clock, and I would go home. And I'd give incredible quality time to my family, and then I don't require much sleep, so I'd open up my briefcase and work again at night. And my husband pulled through. He's awesome. But I used to give lots of speeches on work-life balance. So when I came to the Red Cross, I don't know if it was the direness of the situation because we were in financial straits, or my love for the organization. Like, I've loved every job I've ever had in Denver, including the one I had when I was 14 years old and I was a cashier. So I just love to work. But I am in love with the Red Cross. So the work-life balance thing has sort of gotten out of skew. And my daughter is now in college. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me because I enjoy the work.
Yeah, it's not even work sometimes when you're
just
having...
It doesn't feel like work.
Yeah, right.
It really doesn't.
Exactly, I know what you mean.
And my husband is very tolerant of me loving this job. So I'm personally not practicing it as much as I should, but I do encourage my team to take time off. If they need to leave, I would never say, no, you have to stay.
Yep.
You know, I know every one of their kids' names. I know what soccer games they're playing. I mean, I try to encourage it and make sure that people know that it's okay and encouraged.
Yeah. I had Aaron Hurst on the show a while ago. He is the founder of the Taproot Foundation, and he had a great quote. And it was, if you haven't managed volunteers, you really have never managed. And despite having had those senior leadership positions at ATT and Fidelity earlier in your career, Gail, you have said you have learned more about leadership at the Red Cross than at those other positions. What have you learned?
So that quote about the volunteers is exactly right. So, you know, I prided myself when I was in corporate of being a reasonable boss, a supportive boss. I would gather input, very participative boss. When I would go from job to job, people would want to join me in the new job. So, you know, I always felt like I was a good leader.
I can see that.
But at the end of the day, after we debated and everybody's opinion was heard, I would say, okay, I've heard it all, and now we're all going to jump. And everybody would say, how high? So you turn to volunteers and you say, here's the direction we're going to go. And you go, jump. And they go, no.
Yeah.
It's very humbling. And I'm thinking, what do you mean no? And then I start thinking about it. And it's like, I can't take away their bonus. I can't give them, you know.
No leverage. What do we do?
There's no leverage.
Yeah.
And what it taught me is the best way to lead is through the influence of your ideas, not the power of your office. And when you convince a volunteer to do something, it's probably the right thing to do. I mean, they're a great check. I mean, it's sort of like having a toddler at home. You know, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. You walk in the house and you're not big anymore.
Oh, no.
You can't say, do you know who I am? It's the same thing with volunteers, and it's humbling. It taught me very much how to lead from the heart more than the head.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a quantitative sciences major, so that left side of my brain, it likes to get engaged. So, you know, I've learned to lead through the lens of the mission. I've learned that everyone wants to have a higher purpose in life, and I should have tapped into that when I worked at AT&T and at Fidelity.
What would you do differently if you were to be transported back there today?
It's a great question. So at AT&T, if people would get overly excited and I felt like I needed to calm them down, I would say things like, people, we're not saving lives here. It's telephone calls.
Yeah.
Just calm down. At Fidelity, I'd say, people, we're not saving lives here. It's just managing money. Calm down. But people want to be part of something bigger than them. And what I should have done is say, this work is really important. We are connecting people with the people they love, with the data they need. Or we're making people's financial dreams come true. We're putting kids through college. We're helping people retire.
Oh, I see.
There's a heartfelt reason why people come to work. I don't care what you do. There's a heartfelt reason why people come to work. And if I could transport, I would tap into that and I still probably would have moments where I'd have to say jump, but for the most part, when you lead through the heart, you're much more authentic and credible. And, you know, it's a slippery slope, particularly for a woman, to be frank. You don't want to come off too cheesy.
Yeah.
But when you're leading a mission-driven organization, you can always lead from the heart.
Well, that's right. And I think you sometimes think you're coming off cheesy, but then you find out the way people respond, you're not coming off that cheesy. They really embrace it and buy into this. Let me close with this, Gail. Now, you've been out there at the Red Cross for about a decade, which is a relatively long time these days. And as you have strived to change and better the institution invariably also changes you. How has the American Red Cross changed you, not just as a leader, but as a person over the past 10 years?
So I've become much more humble. I've become much more grateful. I have a deeper love for our country. Hmm. I've always loved being a U.S. citizen, but you see the resiliency of people who have lost everything. You don't see that in other countries during disasters, and I've been around.
Mm-hmm.
You see the generosity of the American public. I got a $1 gift that came from the Tooth Fairy with a letter from a seven-year-old and said, can you use this to help people? I mean, you see that. Oh, my gosh,
yeah.
You see that, and, you know, it's humbling.
Mm-hmm.
I've been back and forth to Haiti a number of times. My first trip there was 4 days after I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I was feeling kind of sorry for myself until I got there. And when I learned that 1 in 10,000 people that live in Haiti will ever see a doctor in their lifetime, and I had 6 different doctors giving me second opinions for my recurrence of breast cancer, I came home and I thought, I am not going
to
complain about this
Gets
or
you away
anything
from your
else.
Own problems, doesn't it?
It really does.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. And so I'm just grateful for everything I have, and I think I'm a kinder person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just tiny little acts of kindness, you can do them every day. And, you know, I know people pay it forward when they experience it.
Well, it sounds like it's been a great marriage. Well, Gail McGovern, the president and CEO of the American Red Cross, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. How can listeners become involved, take a training class, become a volunteer, or financially support all the work that you do?
They should go to our website, redcross.org, and they can do all the things you described. We have an 800 number, 1-800-RED-CROSS, and we just love people that volunteer their time. No gift is too small. We'll put it to great use, and giving the gift of life and donating blood is really precious, too.
Well, thanks, Gail. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Same here. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.